From the studios of WRPI in Troy, New York, this is Little Brother, the show where we talk about high technology, low intelligence, what happens when you mix the two, and where, like any responsible little brother, we tell on Big Brother. My name is Chuck Ritter, and I'll be your host for the next 2 hours as we explore this world of the high tech. This is episode 15 of Little Brother, dated August 3rd, 2001. Stay tuned. Little Brother is right around the corner. Okay, the program is Little Brother. My name is Chuck Ritter. And we have a couple of guests in the studio tonight who have just arrived. So we're going to take just a moment to get them set up, and then we'll get started. I think we're just about lined up here. So quick moment for introductions around. First of all, Phil and Lil are here, and those of you who tuned in 2 weeks ago will remember them, or maybe you won't, but I would hope that they were memorable. Say hello, Phil.
Hello?
Say hello.
Well, I don't know about Phil, but I was memorable.
My headphone doesn't work.
We'll get that sorted out in a minute, I guess. And we have our new person here tonight. Why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Cullum.
Hello, Cullum.
Hello.
And Welcome to my world. Okay, I suppose we ought to get started here. First of all, the phone lines here at WRPI Studios are area code 518-276-6248. Please feel free to call in if you have any comment on any topic that we discuss, even if we've already passed it, or if you're psychic and you know what the next topic is going to be, for example, the fact that Phil has just broken the headphones, then we can talk about that, too. Also, we need to let you know that
it's chewing into my head.
Well, you can't have that.
I think that's the set I had the last time.
You know, it might be. I don't know.
Every time you turn your head, it rattles.
There's the one problem that we do run into is that we do go through a lot of equipment because there are a lot of people in and out of here using it through the course of a day. And I don't know. I think we may have to see if we can pin down another headset for you, Phil.
This one
high technology and low IQ.
At any rate, the opinions and views expressed in those programs, including the fact that Phil's headset is broken, are strictly those of the participants, not necessarily those of WRPI, the Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, or the Rensselaer Student Union.
That's right, because WRPI believes that we have a fine set of headphones here.
And responsible parties with an opposing viewpoint may request airtime for a rebuttal.
I have an opposing viewpoint.
Well, you're going to have to request your time for the rebuttal.
Okay.
Go on, request your time for a rebuttal.
Oh, I'd like to officially request time for a rebuttal.
Okay, go ahead.
What's your rebuttal?
Go ahead.
Oh, I forgot. I forgot my rebuttal.
Oh, okay. Well, what good is it then?
None whatsoever.
Anyway, let's move on to some items off of comp risks. In New York's Westchester Medical Center on July 27, 2001, the head of a 6-year-old boy was severely smashed by a metal oxygen tank that had been attracted by the 10-ton electromagnet during a post-operative MRI. He died two days later. The exam was intended to check his progress after a benign tumor had been removed from his brain. Those who are familiar with the risks for him are long noted a tendency towards prolonged disregard for warnings of severe risks, and here's a quote from the MRI risks from the National Institutes of Health in 1987. They said, quote, "The National Institutes of Health stress the danger of leaving objects that can be magnetized near a machine, near an MRI machine. The most important risk is the projectile effect, which involves the forceful attraction of ferromagnetic objects to the magnet."
That's nothing. My head was severely damaged by these headphones a few moments ago.
Well, there's a first aid kit in the next room.
I've got a steel plate in my head, which, from Vietnam, a Vietnam injury. Steel plate in my head.
Probably want to avoid an MRI.
So if you ever have to go get an MRI with Colum around, look out, because he can become a projectile.
I have become a projectile object before in the past.
Due to MRI?
And motorcycles.
Oh, that hurts. That hurts just thinking about it. By the way, there's a risk there that probably ought to be spoken about too, but not tonight.
Always wear your helmet.
Sound advice. An article by Lisa Guernsey in the New York Times on July 31st, 2001 notes that AT&T Labs will start selling a system called Natural Voices that turns printed text into speech, seemingly in the voice of an arbitrary individual for whom the system has been tailored after analyzing something like 10 to 40 hours of recordings. The results are quite remarkable in capturing personal inflections and intonations, although by no means perfect. The technology is, of course, fascinating. However, it undoubtedly lead to advertisements mimicking the voices of all sorts of famous folks. The risks, of course, are legion, masquerading, fraud, etc., and raise many issues such as who owns the rights to a particular person's voice. This technology will, of course, further muddy the legal waters over real versus simulated characters doing nasty things.
But on the other hand, we'll no longer have to listen to recordings such as, you know, you have 45 minutes remaining on this phone card.
Well, it looks like we have a caller on the line, so let's see what he wants. Hello, caller. You're on WRPI.
Yeah. Are you awake?
I'm sorry?
Are you awake, or is this a recording?
No, this is real. Okay. I am really here. I am really awake.
Okay. A couple of things. I wanted to say.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a long-time listener to WRPI,
mm-hmm.
25, 30 years,
mm-hmm.
and I appreciate you people to no end.
Well, I greatly appreciate the listenership.
Yes. Okay. Well, that bonehead said he was in Vietnam. It's like, was he kidding himself or what?
I believe so.
Yeah.
I think we just put the headset on him, so if you want to talk to him.
He must be on drugs.
Well, I don't know if he is or not. Colum, are you on drugs?
No.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, he don't know the first thing about Vietnam. Okay. Like I say, I'm a long-term.
Mm-hmm.
From 1968, 1969, I've been listening. And your station is great. In the last 2 years, and I'll say last 2 years, you've gone into this lot of talk radio and less music.
Okay.
I'm just have a little problem with that.
Okay.
And you can document that, you know, as however you document your caller, listener, flavor, whatever your thing is. And I appreciate the democracy, radio, and whatnot. But when it becomes about noontime and 1 o'clock...
I'm sorry, caller. Can you please mind your language?
Oh, I'm sorry. You're not got me on the radio, do you?
Yes, I do.
Oh, no. Turn me off.
Okay, Let me take you offline, then.
Yeah, sure. No. Absolutely not.
Okay, you're off. I'm going to what I'm going to do is I'm going to put you on hold for now, and we'll come back to you in a minute. All right?
Okay, a minute.
Okay. I guess we're going to go to some music. This seemed appropriate since this is a show about technology.
I'm so
listening to 91.5 FM, WRPI, Troy. The show is Little Brother. The topic is technology. And we're going to carry on where we were before, back to the items off of comp.risks. Let's see here. Lost my track of where I was here. Phone lines of the firefighters in all regions of Slovakia were severely overloaded for 2 days as tens of thousands of calls were made into it. The cause was a hoax SMS spreading on the network of one of the GSM operators stating that it's possible to make free phone calls using this number. The GSM operator itself also had minor problems in some areas. Despite coverage in main news, the calls continued also into the next day. Many people apparently did not recognize that the number is an emergency one and blindly called it. Even more people forwarded the message to all friends without thinking of it or even trying it. Risks number one. You don't need any mail client executing scripts to spread some piece of info faster than the system is able to handle. A plain old human stupidity fully suffices and, in this case, endangered human lives. Don't assume that if one is intelligent enough to use services such as SMS that he or she won't respond to this kind of a hoax. That particular operator had less than 700,000 customers. The number of calls made was quoted as tens of thousands. Go figure. Risk number two. If the originator was smart enough to use web to SMS gateway via some anonymizer, he's practically untraceable. The individual would be facing 8 to 10 years in prison. The intent of the callers and forwarders will be much harder to prove, and our justice already is overloaded enough, so they probably don't have to fear that much. And that came to us from Stanislav Meduna, who... by the way, just quick glossary items so that you can follow the item here. SMS is the short message service that's included with GSM mobile telephones, and GSM is the group system mobile that is used in most of Europe and Asia and by some handful of carriers here in the U.S. And one of the advantages to this system, it is all digital and the people can roam from country to country with their phone and still stay in touch. Anyway, the SMS service, you can send an email to a particular address and it will get dropped on somebody's phone display. Anyway. Those of you who have been paying attention have heard of the CIRCAM virus. This is a virus that goes out and infects somebody's computer and sends emails out to anybody in the address book, which emails contain a private file, property of the person whose computer was infected. And it pretty much picks a file at random and sends it. And they're saying here, this is from Declan McCullough at The Well. He says, CIRCAM is an amazingly noxious critter. I'll give you an example. At Wired News, like other news organizations, we have feedback addresses so people can send us thoughts on articles. Those have been the same for at least 3 years, so they're well known and available to programs like CIRCAM that scan hard drives for email addresses. Since 1 a.m. Eastern Time on July 24th, they've received about 150 megabytes of mail directed at those addresses, the vast bulk of it, CIRCAM output. A quick scroll through of the messages says that about 90% of it by message and 99% of it by size is due to CIRCAM.
Yeah, at where I work, we actually got hit with the CIRCAM virus when it first came out, before there were any fixes for it. And it took about 4 hours to clean that thing off, about seven computer systems.
Oh, I received it 11 times. Just the other day.
We're still getting responses from people, you know, that have the virus attached to their emails. It's horrible.
Actually, I'll tell you, I had there was one attempt that I had seen to infect my systems with it, and it was ineffective because, of course, I'm, as I've said before, I don't use Microsoft's software. But there was one attempt from CIRCAM, and I got probably 30 or 40 attempts in the past month from Code Red to infect my web server, which also failed miserably for the same reason.
Well, the funniest thing about CIRCAM is at work we have a bunch of people we correspond with, and I got two emails from one individual in particular, and the first one was like, Joe, you know, what is this document? I can't open it in MS Word. And then the second message is like, hi, how are you? You know, I need your advice on this document, which, of course, is the text outputted by the virus.
Yeah, it sounds to me like the second version there is the version that we've heard the most about. It picks a document pretty much at random, attaches it to an email, and the email says, I'm sending this for your advice. And actually, I might point out that it's particularly bad English.
Yeah, it seems to me whenever I've received a virus email, it's always improper grammar or something like that. It's always sent by someone who can figure out how to write these incredible, incredible programs that invade everyone's computers, and they can't figure out the English language.
Well, nobody said English was their native language. You don't
it's
know where one of
possible.
This comes from
it's entirely
until
possible.
You've finally tracked down patient zero.
And then I had to go around the day that I received it 11 times. I had to go around to everyone in the office and explain to them it can come from anyone, it can say anything. The only thing I can tell you is that they'll ask for your advice. That's the only thing I can tell you.
Well, you can kind of look for the you can kind of look for the particular string of poor English. I don't think that changes from one iteration to another.
Yeah, sometimes the suffixes are telling, but in this case they were different from the little three character suffixes dot something, you know, dot BMP dot something else. And the one that we received had different suffixes than the one that Phil got.
Actually, you know what I had seen from my angle, and the majority of Windows users would not see this because by default, Windows hides the true extension of a file, was that the one I had received ended with .doc.lnk. And so it would have shown up, presumably, in Outlook as being, in this case, Brian's resume.doc. And I thought it was kind of amusing that somebody was sending me a resume because, okay, yeah, I have some connections, but I'm not the person to talk to if you're looking for a job. I've maybe found one person a job in the past 5 years.
Yeah, we got snow closing procedures, which is amusing. It was July at the time.
Oh, that is amusing. That is really amusing. Looks like we have another caller here. Let's see if we can bring him on and see if we can do this without offending him.
Yeah, let's see if somebody else will give Colin a nice dressing down.
Hello, caller. You're on the air.
Am I, like, on the air?
You are on the air.
I'm really on the air.
You really are on the air.
Okay, well, I wanted to talk about these talk shows. No, all right. I wanted to talk about the viruses you're talking about.
Go for it.
I got that virus.
Which one, Sircam?
I'm not sure what it was called, but it sounds like the exact same thing. It would, you know, it was an attachment to a file, and it said something like, I send this to you for your advice. It was in bad English.
Yep.
And what I did, actually, I got it four times in the space of 2 days, and then somebody sent me an apology saying, I think you may have gotten this from me.
Mm-hmm.
But the name was not the name of anybody I recognized, although I often get email from strangers. So, and then I checked the link, and I didn't realize what kind of link it was, which was a very scary thing.
Uh-oh.
You know, so, I mean, I didn't realize what kind of attachment it was. You know, is this a DOC attachment? And as you said, it ended in DOC.LNK. And then there was a second one that ended in something else. And then I wrote back to the person, just hit the reply button and said, you know, I'm sorry, I don't recognize your name and I don't know what this is. Will you please refresh my memory as to where I met you and send it to me as text? And then that returned to me and bounced. You know, so there was like nobody there. So then I said, I don't think this is a good thing. I don't think I'll open it.
I'll tell you what that tells me, actually, is it tells me that the person whose computer sent that to you probably had his computer misconfigured. It probably thought that it had one particular address when, in fact, it was something else, which means that pretty much any email that this person sent off of that computer would bounce back to whoever... Any email that this person sent out of that computer would have a bad address on it, so if you tried to reply to it, it would bounce. And some people do that as a form of spam protection. For example, if they were going to put a post up on Usenet, they would mask their real email address so that you got these people that go through and they'll rake through the Usenet news groups looking for addresses, and when they get them, they make a list and they start spamming them because they already know what your interests are based on where you posted.
Well, yes, but sometimes they don't confine the spam to your interests.
This is true.
Yeah, I mean,
this is true. Spam is definitely shotgun advertising. It is not targeted.
Yeah. Oh, and let me alert people to another thing while I'm here. Speaking of spam.
Go ahead.
Okay, for the record, and I'm sure you are just dying to know this, I have never called a 1-900-SEX number in my life, but I received some spam saying that I should. Okay, now here's the trick. Okay, many people have received spam saying, check out our great pornography.
Mm-hmm.
But this one said at the bottom, if you want to be removed from this list, call the following telephone number.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a Caribbean telephone number.
Uh-oh. You didn't call it, did you?
No, I caught it.
Oh, good.
I know all about Caribbean phone line scams.
Okay.
You do too, right?
Yes, I do, but I will. I can either take the liberty and fill the listeners in, or you can.
Well, I'm supposed to keep my outgoing calls short, so I will let you do that. The other thing is one of those emails I got. I thought this was troubling. One of those emails with the virus attachment. It said Frank's eulogy.
What?
Frank's eulogy.
Oh, dear.
God forbid you knew somebody
did you know
named
Frank
who just died. I did not.
Yeah. Well, what the virus does is it, whoever's computer it infects, it searches their My Documents folder, and it just randomly selects a file. So it could be if you actually caught the virus and you had a file in your My Documents folder called joe.doc, it could randomly just pick any file, including that one, and send it out with the virus attached to that document.
Okay. Well, anyway, I'll let you go. I think this is a great talk show.
All right. Thanks for your thoughts, and thanks for calling.
All right. And you'll explain that Caribbean phone thing and all that good stuff, right?
Yes, I will. But before I do, I will announce to the listeners that the number here, if you want to throw your opinion in, is area code 518-276-6248. And what this caller was alluding to about the Caribbean phone numbers is this. There was a scam many years ago, and I suppose it's been repeated a number of times, where they'll give you a phone number and they'll say, call this number to claim your prize or find some enticement to get you to call this number. And at the time, the only area code in the Caribbean was area code 809, although I know at this point in time there are several more. They've done several splits through there. But, like, for example, the Bahamas are 242, but I don't know the rest of them. Anyway, when you place a call to one of these particular numbers, they have you placing the call to the equivalent of a 976 number. So, in addition to your long-distance charges plus your international charges, you're getting a per-call charge, just like you were calling one of the 900 sex lines, or sometimes worse. And because of the fact that it is outside of the U.S., it falls outside of the jurisdiction of the U.S. government, outside of the jurisdiction of the FCC, even though these countries are sharing the same phone system with us, and that you don't have to dial the usual prefix to get an international call. To call anywhere in the U.S., Canada, or the Caribbean all share a single country code of 1. And to call from any one of them to any other one of them, you just dial 1 plus area code, etc. So you're not even aware when you place the phone call, unless you're paying attention, that the phone call is leaving the country. Here we sit in area code 518, and somebody listening, say, downstate in area code 845 could place a call to here and not be able to tell it as being any way significantly different from a call placed to area code 519, which is quite a bit to the north and a bit to the west of us up in Ontario. And so that person placing the 519 call would get all kinds of taxes thrown on as well, not to mention the fact that, like I said before, the call would now fall outside of the jurisdiction of the FCC. As far as I know, none of these scams have been worked from Canada, but they have been worked from a number of Caribbean countries. So that's the story behind that. So if you get a number to call to claim your prize, and it's not an 800 number or an 888 or 8877 or one of those other 8 and then two of the same, toll-free numbers, you might want to check it and just make sure that you don't bump your head on the microphone. You might want to just check it and make sure that it is not an international call, because you could be thrown right into one of these scams.
Do I have to go get a metal plate in my head now? Will I become a projectile if I go near an MRI?
I don't think so.
Oh, and it's pronounced Caribbean, not Caribbean.
Okay. Your correction is noted. Anyway, this one comes to us from Ken Knowlton, who says that the large electronic millennium clock display at Ottawa's National Research Council has been losing an hour every Sunday, although the clock itself remains accurate to within a few millionths of a second per year. The problem appears to be from botched software to handle the daylight savings cutover on April 1st, 2001. Incidentally, the display includes a plaque saying that the Millennium Clock celebrates Canada's rich history of leadership in timekeeping. Apparently, the display has been plagued by problems since it was installed in June 1999 to celebrate the turn of the century and intended to exist only through the Y2K cutover. Of course, if they understood about the turn of the century, they would have installed it in 2000 and not in 1999. And I'm sure that's going to generate some calls, so please pick up your phone and dial 518-276-6248.
Yes, because even though it's 2001, the great 1999 versus 2000 debate is not over.
Well, we got a fresh round coming up between 2010 and 2011. Yes, I know. It doesn't matter one whit.
Do the words obsessive compulsive mean anything?
Yes, they do. Yes, they do. Okay, anyway. A married couple... Oh, this is cute. A married couple in China ended up brawling after realizing that they had unwittingly courted each other over the internet. The pair from Beijing sneaked online to flirt with their mystery girlfriend and boyfriend at a chat site called the Green Green Schoolyard. After a month, the man arranged to meet with his ideal new friend, only to discover it was actually his wife. He'd not known her username.
Wow, how many people get to meet their ideal woman and find out that it's actually their wife?
One would hope.
Most times it happens exactly the opposite. You know, you meet your wife for the first time and, you know.
One would
she's
hope
anything
that,
but the ideal woman.
One would hope that she was. At any rate, they each agreed to carry a certain newspaper to identify themselves, but were shocked when they came face-to-face and started fighting in the street. Passers-by eventually alerted security guards, who had to separate the two.
I don't know why they're fighting. I mean, they're obviously made for each other.
Yeah.
Or at least they deserve each other.
They're both cheaters.
Yes, but can you cheat on your wife with your wife?
Apparently you can.
Apparently he thought so, and apparently she thought along similar lines.
But where is the relationship going now? Are they still together, or, you know,
did
they divorce each other, or...
I just don't know.
Did they branch out into, you know, some kind of jello wrestling, or...
We need to follow up on this story. I want to know what happened.
Okay.
Do they have Jerry Springer over there?
They should now.
Go on that show. You can get the lowdown.
Oh, obviously they need him over there now. Okay. Let's see. What else do we have here? This comes to us from Greg Cyril. He says he just happened to look up Apple.com, and what came out was... let's see. What came out of the Whois server was apple.com.is.the.choice.of.all.self.respecting.terrorists.net. apple.com.is.crad-neat.but.so.is.jimphillips.org. And, of course, apple.com. To single out one record, look it up with three characters, where the three characters are one of the records displayed above. Actually, it gives you a three-digit number with each one. If the records are the same, look them up with equals and the three characters to receive a full display for each record. The registry database contains only .com, .net, .org, .edu domains and registrars. Incidentally, Apple has some of those, sure, but I think if you were to look up Microsoft in the same manner, you would find something far more amusing. You'd find, I think, somewhere around 3 or 4 dozen entries that are all along those same lines. And I don't even want to think about what Verizon shows. Which reminds me, by the way, the email address, if you want to email me rather than voicing your opinion with your own voice, is critter@verizoneatspoop.com. Anyway, according to the ISC Network Operations Center, at 5:15 p.m. on July 23, 2001, more than a dozen buildings lost their network connectivity due to a fiber cut. Okay, that was the University of Pennsylvania. Just a short little item like that, I guess. Okay, they're out. We're here. We're out here at RPI right at the moment too. Let's see. The Rocky Mountain News reports that Denver's 911 call centers are being overwhelmed by increasing numbers of phone calls, some of which are never answered because of staffing problems. A tragedy has not yet happened, but the story suggests that this is mere luck, noting a shooting in which 911 calls were ignored. One-touch 911 buttons make calling easier. Many calls now come in to report a minor accident instead of just a few. Then there are the calls operators receive by accident when somebody jostles their phone in their purse, pocket, or their utility belt. Construction workers in particular often dial 911 by mistake while leaning over guardrails to assess their work. We can hear the entire conversation, but they can't hear us because of all the background noise. This is really a common thing for us, said person's name is Hellburn, but it doesn't say what the first name is. The risk is making it too easy for everybody to contact help in an emergency, resulting in a type of unintentional denial of service attack. Incidentally, I've seen this one happen myself because, as it happens, my own mobile phone contains 911 in the phone number, and if your finger happens to skip on the first two digits and you somehow miss the big two key at the top, you do end up talking to 911. And yes, we did find that out the hard way. Let's see. Quest Wireless apparently had a major error in their billing software and appeared to be billing customers at hundreds of dollars per minute for usage in excess of their allotted monthly limits. Quoting an article from the Minneapolis Star Tribune, some 14,000 of Quest's wireless phone customers in 14 states were vastly overcharged, said spokesman Bryce Hollowell. The errors resulted from a glitch in the new Quest computerized billing system. Customers whose calls exceeded the number of free minutes on their wireless calling plans were billed at excessive rates. The glitch has been corrected.
Where can I sign up? Do they have like a yearly plan?
You know, it serves them right for using more than their allotted minutes. I bet they'll never do it again.
I'm sure that if you really want to figure it out, you could probably take the company name and drop a 3 W's in front of it and a com on the end of it, and it'll probably take you right to it. Well, maybe it's a net. I don't know. These guys are an I think these guys are an ISP also.
Now, I still have a cell phone that hasn't been active in quite a few years, but I still keep it around just because you can dial 911 on it for emergencies. And at home, you know, I don't have a phone hooked up. I just place calls over the internet using, you know, net-to-phone. So it's always nice to have something laying around where you can make an emergency call if you need to.
Oh yeah, I mean, I would hate to see what would happen, you know, without that phone, if you had to make an emergency call and your computer was down.
Well, you can't make 911 on the computer, I don't think. You can't make the call.
You know, that actually makes sense, because how on earth?
How would they know which 911 to forward you to?
Yeah, exactly. That's something that I had not thought of.
However, I'd imagine that probably what would happen is one of us would run across the hall to the neighbors and dial 911 from there.
That's true.
Yeah. You know, low-tech solutions.
Oh, yeah. Low-tech solutions are not necessarily a bad thing.
That's an example of low-tech, high IQ.
Or yes. If your house is on fire, you could always just send smoke signals for help.
Yes.
Okay.
You use the cats as a flare.
Right.
Light them up.
Okay.
They're nice and fluffy. You know, they make good flares.
Oh, let's see.
No cats were harmed in the making of this radio program.
No, absolutely
yes,
not.
Please, no irate calls on this. No irate calls.
Well, I don't know. No calls at all right at the moment. Area code 518-276-6248
if you want
to put your 2 cents worth in.
If anyone wants to call and yell at me for my...
If you want to put your 2 cents
my
in.
My kitty flare price.
If you haven't got 2 cents, I don't know, put 1 cent worth in. And if you haven't got a, if you haven't got 1 cent, put a half penny in.
Better yet, call us with some of your more than allotted telephone minutes so you can get charged $100 a minute.
518-229 no, that's the wrong number. 518-276-6248. That would have been really bad if I gave that number out. That would have been the infamous one that's got the 911 in the middle of it.
And for a good time, call 518-476-1111.
Oh, yeah, actually, we could call that right now. At least I think we can. Let me try this here. What was it, 476?
476-1111.
Oh, it's busy.
It's probably busy from all the folks that we had, from all the folks that just called it just now when you announced that number. What is that?
But it's so important to know what the weather is.
It's national,
that's the weather,
yeah,
one.
The
okay, that's what I thought. That's what I thought. Okay, well, let's see. Let's see. Past couple of weeks, I've been talking about Dmitry Sklyarov, whose name I'm still not certain I've pronounced correctly. Oh, hey, we have a caller. Let's bring him on.
Oh, my.
Hello, caller. You're on the air.
Hi. I got a question about sending email from one computer to another computer that I would have at my house.
Mm-hmm.
Is there an easy way to know that I'm not sending someone else garbage by checking it out on another computer in the house first? Like if there's attached garbage?
Well, if you did... Well, okay. Let's back up a second. First of all, if you do have a virus or some sort of other mechanism in your computer that was just randomly attaching files to email that you were sending out anyway, mm-hmm. then certainly if you were to carbon copy even your own account with that email, when it bounces off of the mail server and comes back to you, you'll be able to take a look at it and see for yourself if it had something attached to it. But the problem with this is that this particular virus would not carbon copy you because of the fact that it's not following up on your initiative to send an email out. It's taking its own initiative to do so.
And it could send it to any address, not necessarily another computer with another account that I would have at my own house then.
Yeah, that's right. It'll pick one out random out of... I'm not sure whether it picks it out of your address book or if it picks it out of people that have sent email to you or gotten email from you or what the scoop is. Although I do know that it seems to be fairly crafty because the one that I received with this from this virus, the return email address was a complete stranger to me. It was somebody that, as far as I know, I had never met in my life or corresponded with at all, and I'm really not entirely sure how my email address ended up in his list. All I can figure is maybe he picked it up from a Usenet post or from a mailing list post that I had made.
Yes, none of us in the office knew the person that forwarded it to us approximately 11 times by accident.
Right, but in the case of a business address. Really, anybody could figure that one out.
Well, it wasn't a generic address. It was a particular person's address. Actually, a couple of them at the office.
Interesting.
Yeah. It's formed out of people's names. You know, it's not... we have addresses that are like, you know, info center at such and such, you know, .org. But this one was someone's name.
It really is a very crafty virus. There's no question about that. No. Probably your best bet to see what's going out. You might want to try installing some firewall software on your computer. And Phil, let me throw a question your way if you don't mind me interrupting you for a second. I know you wanted to step out and for a quick break, but while we have this caller on the line, if you were to install Zone Alarm, can you selectively shut things off, like, for example, shut off outgoing email?
Well, with the Zone Alarm, when you run a program for the first time, you'll get a little menu that pops up and it says, do you want to allow this program to access the Internet? And then you just say yes or no, and it could remember the programs you select. If you're using Outlook Express, it'll ask if you want to allow Outlook Express to access the Internet. If you say no, then you won't be able to receive or send email. If you say yes,
it
then
it sort of
you
defeats
will.
The purpose of Microsoft Outlook.
Well, maybe it does, but what I'm thinking is, can it ask you on a it'll ask you on a case by case basis, right?
No, it generally just asks about programs that are trying to access the Internet,
okay.
And you either pass it or fail it. It's no particular instance for a particular program.
Okay, I was hoping that it was because I was thinking along the lines of. Having something that would intercept the outgoing email and not let the outgoing email go out unless you gave it explicit permission to on a case-by-case basis. But I guess that won't do it. And by the way, the reason I mentioned Zone Alarm is not necessarily to promote any particular product, but it happens to be a freebie, and I know Phil here is using it, so that's why I put the question to him. Does that, I know that doesn't really answer your question, but does it at least point you in a direction?
Yeah, it shows me it's going to be as confusing as I thought it might be.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's put the call out, actually. If anybody out there listening has a potential solution to this one, we would love to hear from you. The number here is area code 518-276-6248.
Okay, all right? Thanks. I'll hang up and listen.
Not a problem. Thanks for calling.
Actually, I want to say something about a Zone Alarm. Last night, it was a strange thing happened. I was just browsing a Ware site, and you have all these pop-up menus, and you know they're sticking things in your favorites folder and things. You know, automatically, you don't want them there. I don't know how it passed Zone Alarm. It must have been some function of the browser that allowed it to do this. But one of the sites I visited actually installed a program in my program folder. And put icons on my desktop.
Actually, I can kind of figure out how it would do that. What it would do, it probably started up some malicious JavaScript, and the JavaScript ran, and the JavaScript downloaded via HTTP. And because it was HTTP, it looked to Zone Alarm like it was your browser doing it. And Zone Alarm didn't know not to let this take place.
Right.
It's amazing the number of things that are now being done through that one protocol.
It's like you don't want to just disable Java entirely on your browser because then you're missing out on some of the positive aspects of it.
Yeah, I know. Actually, I'll tell you one of the things I've noticed lately, though, is that a number of browsers are offering options for various JavaScript commands that you can inactivate, and when you do that, you keep things like pop-up windows from irritating you. Check it out. We've got another caller. Hello, caller. You're on the air.
Hi. You're confusing me.
Well,
you're talking about malicious JavaScript, and I am genuinely confused as to whether you mean JavaScripting or Java applets. Could you please explain that?
Well, I'm talking primarily about JavaScripting because Java applets, by their nature, don't really have the ability to be malicious, or at least not according to specification. Maybe somebody's found a way to... Well, we've lost the caller. Well, I'll finish my explanation anyway.
You confused him, and then you bored him. Hung up. He's had enough of your explanations.
But I think that...
Column
is having technical difficulties.
Well, thank God you have that plate in your head because you can sustain a fall like
it's
that.
Because he's on drugs.
Now he'll have to go get an MRI. His chair will become a projectile.
Do be careful. We have vicious attack chairs around here.
That chair needs to be looked at by me.
The chairs work about as great as a headphone.
Yes, by the way, I went to seek out a two-headed headphone, and I could not find a single pair where both the ears worked.
And, you know, it's always the right-hand one. It's always the right-hand one. I can figure out why it is with this pair of headphones, because the wire comes in the left and goes over top, so it's a longer wire run, but it doesn't seem to matter. Any pair of headphones I have ever picked up that has had one ear go out, it's always been the right. Explain that one to me, somebody, please. Yeah, and Phil's pointing at his headset like he can't hear me.
No, this is the one that's out.
Oh, the left one's out in
yours?
Well, I would stand humbly corrected.
All right, we thought we had another mystery, like the missing left sock, but you're wrong.
Is that significant?
I do not believe so.
Oh, no. That's got to be it. Phil's left-handed.
Do you think somehow Phil has formed a symbiotic relationship with his headset? It is adapted?
Well, he picked out the headset.
Mm.
You know, it wasn't plugged in there when he came in here.
Well, I'm just going to step out for a moment and have a cigarette and only inhale it from my left lung. I'll be right back.
Okay. At any rate, going back to Dmitry Sklyarov, and I don't know if I'm pronouncing his name right. Or
maybe it's Sklyarov.
Sklyarov or it's something like that. It's S-K-L-Y-A-R-O-V, but I know that...
Sklyarov?
That's what I thought. But I've heard other people say it's Sklyarov. It's hard to say because of the fact that it's...
At least it has some vowels. That's helpful.
That it does. But, you know,
it could use some more.
Yes, it definitely could. I think Y is a vowel in this case.
Yeah. Actually, in this case, I think it could use a consonant, perhaps.
I don't know.
Mm. Yeah, you don't have to buy the consonants, though.
So. No. Mm. No, but the consonants don't really grant you any ability to have a vowel movement. I'm sorry. That was really rotten.
Where's that extra pair of headphones? They're broken anyway. I can chuck them at you with impunity.
Okay.
If any callers would like to call in and give him hell for that lousy, horrible joke, please feel free. But don't call about lighting the cats on fire. Don't call.
518-276-6248. Anyway, what's going on with Dmitry? And I've spoken about this case the past couple of weeks, and I'm going to continue to speak about it for as long as this show is on the air, or for, I don't mean tonight, I mean week after week, or until Dmitry is released from jail. But in a nutshell, I'll tell you the story really quickly. Dmitry Sklyarov is a programmer who works for a Russian software company called Elcomsoft, and he wrote a program that would break a certain form of encryption. The particular encryption pertains to Adobe ebooks. And basically what happened is he came to the U.S. and he gave a presentation on the topic. And as soon as his presentation was done, he was arrested. He was arrested for violating the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which is, in my humble opinion, the biggest abortion of a law that has ever hit the books in this country, because it takes away First Amendment privileges. It, where am I going here? It takes away fair use rights. And basically the rule is that if you were to come up with any kind of a tool to circumvent encryption, that tool is illegal, and you are a criminal. Apparently, it now no longer matters that the alleged crime took place outside of U.S. jurisdiction in a place where the alleged crime is not a crime. So, at the first chance, they grabbed Dmitry, and he has now been in jail for 2 weeks. I sense that we have another Kevin Mitnick-type case coming on here, where somebody is thrown in jail and basically stays there, never seeing the inside of a courtroom until some heinously long length of time passes. Anyway, that's my 2 cents worth on that one. By the way, Adobe went and have basically asked the U.S. Department of Justice to withdraw the charges. And go ahead.
I'm sorry. I have breaking news. My headphones work.
Both ears?
Both ears.
Amazing.
Both
ears. I got a crackle out of my right ear, but that's about it.
I get crackling if I wiggle. Mm-hmm.
But Adobe dropped the charges, or attempted to drop the charges, and the Department of Justice still wants to prosecute, so Dmitry stays in jail. And I'm sorry, that's just flat out wrong. Okay. So I suppose at this point in time, I probably ought to advise you that you're listening to 91.5 FM WRPI in Troy. It's 8 o'clock. The show you're listening to is Little Brother. The opinions and views expressed in this show are strictly those of the participants, not necessarily those of WRPI, the RPI Student Union, the Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, or anybody else who may, for whatever purpose, choose to claim them. The opinions that come out of my mouth are mine. You can't have them. Well, okay, I'll share. Anyway, the phone number here is area code 518-276-6248. 518-276-6248. If you have an opinion, I'd love to hear it. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to Little Brother. Thank you. You're listening to 91.5 FM WRPI in Troy. The show is Little Brother. The topic is technology. And we have another caller on the line.
Hi.
Hello.
Are you
there?
Hi, I'm fine. Could you say, Dimitri, he's in jail where, has been there how long, and was put there by who?
Yes, I can. Or at least I can attempt to. I know that last I had heard, he was actually in Oklahoma.
Uh-huh.
The impression that I get is that they operate sort of like, almost like FedEx. You know, they take you to a central clearinghouse and then move you out from there.
Uh-huh.
He was arrested in California at the DEF CON, which is a hacker convention that was held a couple of weeks ago, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And let me see. He presently in Oklahoma. I'm sorry, what was the rest of the question?
How long has he been in jail? Where is he in jail? And who put him there? And,
right.
And I didn't say why, but why?
2 weeks. 2 weeks plus a little bit of change.
Uh-huh.
Who put him there? I believe, although I may stand corrected on this one. I believe it was the Secret Service. They have generally been the ones who have prosecuted hacking cases. And the reason why was for violation of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, or DMCA. Now, the problem is that his alleged violation of the DMCA actually took place outside of U.S. territory. So I really think that that had he actually gotten to a courtroom, I know at least if I was the judge, I would give the prosecution a good dressing down for that one.
Mm.
Because he didn't do this on U.S. territory. It's as simple as that.
So this is like the computer equivalent of, putting your money in a tax shelter, Christine Todd Whitman in New Jersey or something, or
Well, the thing of it is, he's a Russian citizen.
Yeah.
He was on Russian soil when he wrote the software.
Uh huh.
And he came to the U.S. for a convention, and they arrested him at the convention.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, they arrested him as he was checking out of his hotel.
This is a stretch because I don't know anything about the case, and I haven't been following the case of the American spy, the American person who was arrested and charged with spying in Russia,
mm-hmm.
who I understand was, they haven't released him. He's in jail, right?
Mm-hmm.
As
far as I know.
Yeah. Do you see any possible, connection to that in terms of a revenge or something?
Now, that is an interesting angle that I had not thought of. Because I do know that apparently the company that Dimitri works for, one of their biggest customers is the CIA.
Uh-huh.
And basically what that company sells is electronic lockpicks.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, I mean, then this is a natural for that to be organically connected to what's happening to this fellow, shall we call him.
Mm-hmm.
In Russia, because I'll start reading about it more carefully now because there's a piece about it now and again in the Times.
And mm-hmm.
I think there was one a few days ago.
Well, I'll tell you a great source to start from because they've been following this case very carefully, very closely.
Mm-hmm.
Would be to go to the website of 2600 Magazine, www.2600.com. They have some very good coverage of this.
Well, that brings me to my next question.
Okay, go ahead.
Which is, I can't go to any website because I don't have, I'm not online. But
mm-hmm.
I wanted to ask you in that respect, if you could recommend any films that are available on, for renting that portray in any sort of a recognizable and legitimate way the current state of cyber technology. For example, and I'm not saying this is, such a film, but the Keanu Reeves films are, on the one hand, which is just, the glitzy side of
yeah.
it. But on
things
the other,
like Johnny Mnemonic.
Yeah, or
in the Matrix.
Right, or the one with Gene Hackman, Enemy of the State.
Yeah, those are all, as far as anybody knows, those are all pure works of pure fiction.
Are there any films that you know of along those lines which are not so, you know, not as you call it pure fiction, but really are based in, you know, some sort of solid cyber terrain, so to speak, that people don't, you know, most people don't know about?
I don't necessarily know about films. I might have a couple of ideas there, but I'll tell you what's an excellent read is The Hacker Crackdown by Bruce Sterling. It's one of his few works of nonfiction, and it's a very riveting book, and it does tell the story of the general behavior of the authorities with respect to the hacking and freaking scene.
And it talks about the history of hacking?
Mm-hmm. Of course, now the thing to bear in mind is that the book is about 10 years old, so it's not exactly the most up-to-date as far as the actual technology goes. However, a lot of the behavior has not changed from what I have been able to see. Maybe I can recommend a couple of films. This one is fairly glitzy as well, I will say, is Hackers.
Okay.
The hacker side of it.
I've heard of that.
The hacker side of it is pretty much glitz, but right. The authority side of it is not.
Okay.
You have the antagonist and the protagonist in the story. The protagonists are definitely shown in a more glitzy than real form, but the antagonists are not.
Is it a good demonstration of contemporary computer capabilities?
No, not really.
Oh, okay.
Not really. As far as that goes, it's mostly a lot of flash animation. Let me see. Another possibility, there are two films. Both are very difficult to land. One of them you pretty much have to have imported is called Takedown. And actually, the only person I've known that's been able to land a copy of it landed a copy that had French subtitles on it, and under the French release of it, it was called Cybertrack.
Mm-hmm.
The other one I had seen, or the other one I had heard of, was Freedom Downtime, and this one has not actually been released on video. It's mostly being shown at conventions and festivals.
Oh, Freedom Downtime?
Yes. And actually, the thing is, Takedown and Freedom Downtime are both the same story, just told from opposite points of view.
Oh, really?
Yes. Takedown is told from the authorities' side of authorities' point of view, and Freedom Downtime is told from the hackers' point of view. It's about Kevin Mitnick.
Okay. Was that the music thing? I'm sorry. Never mind.
Quite all right.
Yeah.
Now Kevin Mitnick was arrested several years ago.
Oh, is this not the one I'm thinking of? Yeah.
He was in jail for probably 3 years and 9 months or so, I believe it was, before he ever saw the inside of a courtroom.
Oh yeah, I think I heard you talking about that another time, and I was wondering if it was this Dimitri, but now this is Redux now.
Yes. Yes, that's what I'm saying. It's actually, I mentioned Mitnick a few minutes ago because of the fact that I thought that perhaps Dimitri's case might turn out to be a rerun.
So, correct me if I'm wrong, but I get the impression that any time anybody who's considered highly skilled in cyberspace is arrested for something, the authorities believe that they are such a threat that they have to be. There can't be any possibility of them getting anywhere within 100 feet of a computer, so they just completely isolate them. I mean,
well, that is actually Kevin Mitnick's status. Last I had heard was that he was not permitted anywhere near a computer, and that pretty much makes him unemployed.
Yeah.
Because,
right.
I mean, he can't even work at McDonald's because they use computers.
Well, yeah, I think what's more likely is that, you know, whatever it is that they think that these people know, they don't want them talking to anybody, even their lawyers, about it. So, let alone, well, anyway. Well, that's good. I had one other question, and then I'll let you go. I was wondering if you were familiar with a film called The Forbin Project.
No.
It's from the early 70s.
But what was it called again?
The Forbin Project.
The Forbin Project?
Yeah, F-O-R-B-I-N. And it's sort of a grade B movie. The star of the movie is one of the characters from the daytime soap operas. He's in his 60s now, but at that time he was still young and handsome, and he's running the U.S. government's latest generation of defense computer apparatus, and apparently, you know, he personally oversaw the construction of it, and it turns out that the plot of the film is that I think his computer is called the Forbin. I don't remember what that stands for, but it's much more advanced than they've ever had before, and it's in way out in the Nevada desert or something. But it's supposed to monitor, you know, literally everything, and solve every problem without. It's supposed to remove the necessity of any human intervention of any kind. This computer takes care of all of the. It controls all the defense apparatus and responds to any threat of any kind. So that and then just tells people about it afterwards.
That's pretty scary, actually.
Well, what happens is that it turns out that the Soviet Union, which still existed at that time, had done at about the same time about the same thing. Their computer technology had advanced to, you know, close enough to the same point that there were now these two computer systems on opposite sides of the trench, so to speak, that were so advanced and so independent, and that's the key thing, that they had been built to be independent of human control to a large extent. They established a relationship with each other that was completely independent and arrived at the conclusion that the biggest threat that they faced was not each other, but the political entities who they were supposed to be protecting. And they staged a coup.
Oh, that's interesting.
It is. I can't believe, you know, I just got it on video back when I was first starting watching videos, and I'd never heard anybody that's seen it. It was just, you know, I thought it was terrific. So, naturally, the guy from the soap opera had to they took him hostage because Forbin recognized that the guy who built it was the only one who could possibly know how to defeat them.
Sure.
And so they weren't... they weren't homicidal. They didn't want to hurt anyone. So he didn't want to hurt his builder, but he wanted to isolate him and hold him and protect themselves against him. And so they did that. But he had to figure out a way around that and how to get access so that he could dismember it, so to speak. And he finally ended up doing it, but it was, you know, I thought it was very interesting at the time. I'd love to see it again, but I haven't seen it around anywhere.
You know, I'm going to say something that will probably that will probably make a few people say, "Oh no," but it strikes me as it actually strikes me as though somebody had taken two particular episodes of the Star Trek original series and slammed them together to produce that.
Because there was
one in which there were two societies that were theoretically at war with each other, but the war was all being fought by computer. There were no actual missiles being fired, and it was all on the honor system. If the computer said, "Okay, you were hit," you would take yourself out of the picture.
No, this wasn't like that. These computers had control of each other's nuclear arsenals.
Right, right.
Their respective nuclear arsenals. And
but
in the film, they actually did, that in order to make the point.
Just the aspect of the two computers establishing a relationship with each other, though, is what made me think of that. The other one, of course, is the ultimate computer, in which there was a case where the machine was trying to isolate itself.
Well, you know, whether or not, you know...
Or rather isolate its creator.
The question of that comes up so often about whether, you know, a thinking machine can actually be a mechanical embodiment of the whole range of human complexity, so to speak, to the extent that you know they make judgments, and which is what was going on in this film. They weren't just making calculations and and responses. They were making judgments, one of the things that distinguishes people from computers is computers, they're slaves. I mean, they can't make judgments about anything except on the basis of what we put into them. But to a limited extent they can on the basis of.
Well, we are having them do things like this. Incorporating various artificial intelligences and setting computers up to examine trends on things. And I've heard horror stories actually. Of people who have run headlong into this type of thing, with their credit cards, they'll go and they'll make some purchase, and the computer will decide, oh, this doesn't seem very much like this person, and initiate a phone call to the person, or worse, freeze the card.
Well, I know that, and they do the same thing with this face recognition business that's going on in Florida, I think.
Oh, I don't like that at all.
Well, but that's the same thing. They have a checklist, and they go down the checklist, and if a certain number ticks off a certain way, then they're programmed to respond, and it's still a calculation. It's not a judgment. The thing about the Forman project was that the computers were making a value judgment about whether humanity or themselves were more viable or more legitimate or more deserving of controlling the Earth, in this case. And they had control of the nuclear button, so that there was one case in which, in order to make their point to the government of the United States, I think it was, or to both governments, they launched one nuclear missile and destroyed a military installation somewhere to show that they meant business.
Mm-hmm.
And so... that was much closer to a value judgment than calculating that someone's facial structure, is enough like Jack the Ripper that he might be walking the streets of Boca Raton,
Yeah, I hear you. It is too much power, definitely, to put in the hands of a computer. Well, I'm going to move on at this point.
Thank you very much.
Not a problem. Thank you for calling.
Okay.
And again, the number here at WRPI Studios is area code 518-276-6248. Got an item from Aaron Dickey, who says that in 1999, USC neurobiologist Joseph Miller asked NASA to check some old data the Viking probes had sent back from Mars in the mid-1970s. Miller wanted to find out whether certain information on gas released by Martian soil, which at the time had been dismissed as meaningless chemical activity, was actually evidence of microbial life. Let me try that word one more time. Microbial life. Yes, I know I could get that word out. NASA found the tapes that he requested, but they didn't find any way to read them. It turns out that the data, despite being only about 25 years old, was in a format that NASA had long since forgotten about, or as Miller puts it, the programmers who knew it had died.
Luckily, Miller has been able to cobble together about a third of the data and get some useful results, but only because some of the printed record had been saved. And yes, he does believe the Viking probes turned up evidence of microbes.
They could probably read that data if they had Commodore computers, but they don't anymore.
Well, let's see, 1970, mid-70s, 75 or so. I think there were a couple of Commodore computers out there at that point in time.
I don't know when the VIC-20 came out.
Oh, no, the VIC-20, no, way before the VIC-20's time. That was 81. But I think there may have been one or two of the PET computers out at that frame and at that point in time.
Boy, I always make fun of my boss because he still has some of those big floppy disks. You remember the ones?
Oh, the 5-inch or the 8-inch ones?
The 5-inch ones.
They're like...
No, the 5-inch ones.
Oh, the little 5-inch?
And I always harass him because he never throws them out. He says, but this is history. This is history. You can't throw this out. I always tease him, but I think I'll stop teasing him now.
It's junk.
We haven't got anything that can read them.
Yeah, well, that tends to make it not particularly useful. Although, if you did find somebody that was into retro computing, and we have a couple amongst our numbers, I think...
Damn fine music.
Two of the four of us are. And yes, some of these older computers made some very good music. Like this, for example.
Maniac Mansion.
Thank you. Okay, the show is Little Brother. My name is Chuck Ritter, and Phil is here, and Cullen is here, and Lillian is here. Say hello, everybody.
Hi.
Hi.
Hello.
And if you're wondering what that weird noise is, it's Cullen's chair.
Yes, he's got the chair with the technical difficulties.
It's the same one that injured him earlier.
Here, take this chair.
He's
I'm not injured.
Lifting.
I'm okay. That chair doesn't recline all the way back into a comfortable position.
It doesn't recline all the way back to the floor.
I'm sorry, if I can't fall out of a chair, I won't sit in it.
Anyway, we did get a call during the break, and the caller informed us that in addition to the Forbin project, there's also apparently been an X-Files episode that was based on the same basic concept, which really makes sense, I suppose. Anyway, if you want to move on here. Oh, by the way, the phone number, if you want to call in, is area code 518-276-6248. Getting some interesting calls tonight, so why don't you throw yours in to boot? Let's see here. Daniel Norton sends us comp.risks a thing saying that my Yahoo Alerts window popped up with an explosive sound this morning to notify me that Motorola's stock value had crashed. Incredulous, I went to the Yahoo Finance page and confirmed it. Undaunted, I proceeded to the New York Times Finance site, which only concurred. Finally, the New York Stock Exchange site confirmed that, in fact, the value of Motorola had been exactly 1 penny at the open, but rebounded spectacularly, even to exceed the previous day's close. Hopefully, anybody who automates trading programs around this kind of glitch, it was a glitch, wasn't it? Risks readers and listeners know that these hopes are not always fulfilled. Let's see what else we have here. We have dead air, that's what we have.
And now here's some more of my chair creaking.
That sounds obscene, man.
Sorry, I'll stop.
Okay. Let's see, Dave Isaacs submits through the Risks Digest. He says, I saw this interesting aside in an Ottawa Citizen article on July 27th, 2001, about JDS Uniphase's latest quarterly results. The world's largest maker of fiber optic components was forced to halt the trading of its stock for most of the afternoon because a hacker broke into its corporate network and stole a draft copy of the company's fourth quarter results. It had been released before the markets closed that afternoon. The obvious risk here is that the consequences of storing very valuable information unencrypted on a network-accessible computer. Nothing new in that lesson. What would be interesting is knowing just how JDS Uniphase knew that this break-in had occurred and what form the break-in took. It sounded like a story we'd all be interested in hearing. As to how JSU found out... Oh, that's a repetitious paragraph there. Anyway, the moral of the story, use a firewall and use encryption. Oh, let's see. The following item appeared in the download disk section of Earthlink weekly email newsletter on July 23rd, 2001. If you tell your browser to save website passwords so that you don't have to re-enter them, you might forget those passwords. Over time. This program can reveal passwords hidden behind those asterisks in website login screens. Freeware. This is a download link, it says. This item highlights an inherent risk of allowing Internet Explorer or Netscape to save your passwords, other than the obvious one that anybody with physical access to your system would also have access to your password-protected pages. Someone with access to your system may be able to determine a pattern to your password choices, especially if you have only one password. You want to say anything about that one?
All my passwords are alphanumeric, and each one's different for every place I go.
Yeah, that's the only way to be, actually, and if you can... Actually, the company I work for has a new policy where they are insisting, and this is not a new policy as far as people doing this ever. I mean, other places do the same thing, but you have to insert some punctuation marks into your password as well. And, I mean, it makes for some really irritating passwords, but the fact of the matter is, as long as you can remember them, they're difficult to crack.
I have the bad habit of just writing my passwords underneath my keyboard,
I know. Yeah. I've seen you do that.
And I try not to do it much anymore, because once I got rid of a computer and I inadvertently gave them the keyboard with the passwords scrawled underneath it, and that was bad.
Yeah, and let's see now. That's got what? That's got the password to my website on it, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Anyway. Let's see. Michael F. Maggard writes, recently it was discovered that the Mac software LiveStage Pro by Totally Hip Software has been reporting back its license usage and environment to its manufacturer via a covert HTTP dialog. The company has refused to respond to the discovery officially, but one of their staff members has been corresponding publicly on the popular Mac website, www.macintouch.com. There he's expressed surprise that anybody is concerned and asserted his business has the full right to include this sort of tracking that it noted deep in one of the README files and permission to electronically verify their serial number is specified within the software license. The non-representative goes on to state that in the future, Totally Hip intends to somehow secure the collected information, and this is all simply a legitimate anti-piracy effort. Finally,
Darn.
He's taken the website as a task for posting letters that would detail how to block the reporting function, edit one's host's file specifically, likens it to supporting software piracy, and closes with, quote, "Honestly, we are not an evil conspiring company." This isn't an isolated incident for Mac software developers. Actually, I'm going to throw in that it's not an isolated incident for any platform, unfortunately. Powerhouse Adobe has been installing a mysterious file of their own that regularly calls home for reasons unknown. Adobe has promised to explain this new feature, what it does, and what it's communicating, but to date they haven't followed through. You know, Adobe's making the news a lot lately. There's this, there's Dimitri, and there was one other thing I had seen recently, and I'll have to see if I can think of what it was. It was something, it was something else that was really privacy busting that they were involved in, but I can't remember what it was.
I mean, if I were a software company, on one side of the coin, I would want to know if the software is legally registered, and maybe if they put something in the program where it would communicate back to the author and with the serial number and IP address and everything. But on the other end, if I was a user, especially if I was a user that didn't have a legal right to use the software, I wouldn't want it to communicate back to the author.
Yes, well, we'll not go there. Oh, looks like we have a caller. Let's see what we have here. Hello, caller. You're on the line. You're on the air.
I just wanted to say that I think the program or the howdy.
Hi. There's an 8-second delay between the time you talk and it'll come out of your radio.
Oh,
so
I see.
If you wouldn't mind turning your radio down, we'd appreciate that.
Sure, no problem. The program that you're thinking of, or the incident that you're thinking of with Adobe, is Killustrator.
That's the one. That is exactly the one. Thank you very much.
Sure, no problem.
I don't know how I could possibly forget that one.
But this guy over in Germany made the software.
Yes. Okay. Background is this, basically. There is a user environment for the Linux operating system called KDE. And it's customary for programs in the KDE environment to have some name that is something sensible with a K put in front of it. And in this particular case...
K drawing thingy, if I remember, from 2 weeks ago.
That's the one. We did discuss this 2 weeks ago. The concept is that they were trying to come up with a reasonable emulation of Adobe Illustrator, or something that at least served the same functional niche, and they ended up naming it Killustrator. And Adobe did sue them over this. And I'm trying to think. I believe they renamed the product to Contour or something along those lines.
Yes,
in order to
with Contour, I believe.
Okay, and the caller has left us, so we'll pat that down so that we don't hear that annoying
Although one would think that they would rethink a name like Killustrator anyway.
You're going to find that as Linux geeks, they've got a really strange sense of humor. I actually
Somebody's
think it's
got
kind of funny.
Software, you know.
Oh, I know. I know exactly what you mean.
Does Adobe make anything for Linux?
One thing that I have seen. exactly one thing. They do make a version of Acrobat Reader for mm-hmm. Linux.
Okay.
And that is it. I have not seen anything else come out of there that was available for Linux. You know, I mean, there have been other companies that have been supporting Linux up and down, but no, that's not one of them. Oh, let's see. We have an item here from William Coburn, who writes. He says, "I live in a small town. Two of the doctors I visit have been my doctors my entire life, and the third in the office has been a friend of the family for just as long. The office has been virtually the same my entire life. They still have the original monochrome monitors on their office PCs. The newest doctor, however, demanded some newfangled ideas as part of the contract to work there. She makes recordings of her medical notes, and they are transcribed by a third-party company. The transcriptions come via email, which the office can't receive, in MS Word 2000, which the office can't read. So she gets them at her house and prints them out. She is out of town for 3 weeks now, and they asked me to take care of this for them. I don't know if my experience is typical of medical transcription business, but I suspect that it is. The transcriptions are made at the office from the doctor reading her notes onto tape. I didn't ask, but I suspect the tape is then mailed or shipped to the transcription agency. The employee there then types up the information and emails it back out to the appropriate place. The email is not cryptographically signed, nor is it encrypted. In the case of my local office, it goes from the ISP to the person doing the work on a local ISP here in Socorro. And the doctor has a wireless link from her house to the ISP and uses an unencrypted POP session. The transcripts are then launched from Outlook into Word and printed out. She saves a local copy onto her hard disk just in case and then deletes them from the server. These documents can contain a lot of information. A medical history will include tremendous personal data, not just on the patient, but on their entire family, including the date of birth and the lifestyle. A simple office visit can be mundanely bland, a broken wrist, to life-shatteringly personal, where someone here was inspired by Bobbitt. But always contains the person's real name, complaint, diagnoses, and prescription. There are numerous places along the trip that this information could fall into the wrong hands. A virus could be present at either end of the email, which might compromise the data. The data passes through ISPs in the clear and could be intercepted or modified while in transit, especially on the wireless link. The wireless ISP is like a scrolling marquee if someone has the right equipment. Outlook likes to keep email on the server, even if the user has deleted it, so all those transcripts could still be on the local internet service provider. And lastly, a copy of everything is stored on her computer in her house and not in the security of the office.
Well, after all the trouble Eli Lilly had, I'm surprised.
Well, I am too, actually, and I'm going to...
Well, I suppose I shouldn't be. They're experts in the medical field, not in technology.
Well, that's true. And in the defense of medical transcription agencies, I have seen some cases where data has been handled far more discreetly than this. I've seen one where, for example, the information is recorded into a phone mail system, and when the doctor hangs up, there's no more connection, no way to read that off of the phone mail system except to actually be present or to use a particular digital recorder matched to the phone mail system in order to download it, and compressed, of course, via modem. And these agencies would then use a dial-up connection instead of an internet provider. Certainly not a wireless internet provider. I mean, that's the stupidest thing in the world. In order to pass the information in, it gets printed out and it gets mailed to the doctor's office, which in my or sent by courier, which in my opinion makes a lot more sense. If you have a thought about this, give a call. Area code 518-276-6248.
There's a big opportunity for this personal medical information to be intercepted by various ass monkeys. Is that what you're saying?
That is indeed what I am saying, and I know you have been dying to use that phrase, and now you've gotten it.
Yeah, hour and a half. Okay. I can sleep well tonight now.
Yeah, you can. Okay. Let's see here. I have an item here from Brian McWilliams. came out over Microsoft bulletins. For at least 4 months, Microsoft has been sending out security bulletins which fail a popular email authentication system. As a result, the company could be opening the door to counterfeit bulletins from malicious hackers. To protect against the forgery, Microsoft Security Response Center digitally signs its bulletins with PGP before emailing them to subscribers of its security notification service. But since at least March, if recipients attempt to verify the message's authenticity, PGP will issue a warning that the bulletins contain an invalid signature. The problem is that Microsoft bulletins effectively look as if they're forged, and telling a Microsoft forgery from someone else's is virtually impossible, said Paul Murphy, head of information technology at Gemini Genomics, a genetic research firm in Cambridge, England. Oh, jeepers, say that three times real fast. Okay, the New York Times reports on July 27th, that on July 17th, theft from nine lockers at an Upper East Side sports club took place. Directly after, they called the police. A call was received from the police fraud department, and four victims responded to a series of questions and gave their credit card numbers, husbands' names, social security numbers, PINs, and mother maiden names. Anything wrong with that? That is, aside from when the police did arrive, they said there is no such department. One woman's tale, she called the credit card issuers but couldn't reach her bank, being after all hours and all that. The next morning, she found $500 had been taken using her bank card. The risk? Stupidity or cupidity aside, is being unlucky enough to be a victim outside banker's hours, and in a bank not having a 24-hour notification phone number. There ought to be a law, as credit cards, that limits a consumer loss to $50 for such cases. P.S. The same woman said she had worked out daily until now, but then now I am so paranoid I haven't been back, she said. That's probably the wrong lesson learned.
Isn't your liability limited on credit cards?
Yeah, $50. Okay, $50. Right. But the thing of it is, this credit card company, just in the case of that one woman, just took a $450 loss.
That was from her bank card, though, not a credit card.
Right, but it's still fraud, and guess who gets to pay for it?
Little old
customers.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
You got ripped off.
Boy.
Yeah, the key is to find the bank where the smart people bank.
Yeah, and not the ass monkeys.
not ass monkeys.
Don't bank where ass monkeys bank, because they can't choose good banks like us.
Check out the teller line every time you visit and look for ass monkeys.
Okay, guys. Okay. I know you guys were dying to use that phrase on the air. You've used it on the air. Knock it off.
I'm just a little bit too happy with myself right now.
I'm not going there. Okay. Let's see. We got an item from Jack Holleran. He says, it'd be interesting to see what the vetting process was for the salesperson in the case of... this is in the case of an identity theft.
Identity theft.
Thank you. I couldn't get that word out for some reason.
Please speak the Queen's English at all times.
How come you could say genome genomics or whatever it was, and you can't say theft?
Snack in between. I have no idea. At any rate, let's see. This came out of MSNBC, and they said key personal data belonging to hundreds of individuals have been shared in an internet chat room in what one expert says could become one of the largest identity theft cases ever. See, there I said it.
Sure, it's fun, isn't it?
Identity theft.
Data includes social security numbers,
Gar,
drivers...
I've taken your identity.
Drivers... Okay.
Hand it over.
Driver's license numbers, date of birth, and credit card information, everything a criminal would need to open an online bank account or apply for a credit card, even create the paperwork necessary to smuggle illegal immigrants. It is still unclear how the idea ended up in the chat room, but an MSNBC.com investigation revealed common threads among the victims, including the purchase of a cell phone online from, oh, guess who, VerizonWireless.com or an AT&T wireless reseller.
And you can email us your opinion on Verizon at...
Critter@VerizonEatsPoop.com.
That's right, Critter@VerizonEatsPoop.com.
Yes, if you're feeling that if you're feeling that you're not willing to let your voice be heard by the entire Capital District, you can email it, and I will put my voice to your thoughts. So send an email to critter@verizoneatspoop.com with your opinions. And by the way, an opinion in and of itself, the opinions and views expressed in this program are strictly those of the participants and not necessarily those of whoever else may, for whatever reason, attempt to claim them. They're mine. Or whoever else happened to be speaking at the moment.
Yes, because WRPI may in fact believe that Verizon does not in any way eat poop.
Observant readers and listeners will have already noted that... okay, let me back up a second here. This comes to us from a guy by the name of Paul Bissex. And his last name is spelled B-I-S-S-E-X. Observant readers, he writes, will have already noted that my last name contains the word sex. Recently, in trying to register with a website using my real name, I was chastised for profanity and asked to choose a different ID. I declined, and since the company has offered no response to my inquiry as to whether this policy is really necessary, I thought I'd share the screen grab. It's at http://bisex.net/paul/profanity.gif if anybody wants to look at it. The business risk, alienating one's customers, is fairly obvious. More broadly, this highlights a familiar problem with bad word list sensorware. Imagine if this were an email filter on a firewall instead of a registration script. Got an item from Mark Brader. On at least three occasions, he says, my battery-operated car unlocked remote control, set off car alarms in nearby vehicles. I found that I could turn on the alarm, and with another press of the remote control, turn it off, ad infinitum. The most astounding of these was the first time it happened in Rochester, New York, but not simply because this was new information that it could set off the car alarm, rather because of the reaction of the owner of the other car. At first, I didn't realize how it was that the nearby car alarm had been triggered, since neither we nor anybody else was close to the vehicle. Eventually, I figured out that I had done it with my remote control. I also figured out that I could turn the alarm off as well as turn it on. As we continued to approach my car, it also dawned on me that the owner of the vehicle in question was also coming across the lot. I pointed to the previous alarm-sounding vehicle and asked if it was his. He said that it was. Lest he had observed what had just happened and somehow thought I was up to no good, I said, "It seems my remote control activates your car alarm." His response? I don't have a car alarm. I looked at my sister, who was perplexed as I was, and decided not to argue or explain. Perhaps I should mention that there was no other vehicle nearby that could have been sounding the alarm. It was not my vehicle. Especially now that this has happened two other times, I'm sure my remote control has triggered his car alarm. The bummer about this is thus. You open your car door. The other person's alarm goes off. You press the remote control again to shut off the alarm, and naturally, your car door locks again. So you now have to unlock your car door. The alarm of the other car goes off, you open the door so you can get in your car, and then you press the remote again to shut off the other car alarm. I suppose if you just gave the alarm enough time, it would shut off on its own. There was a follow-up to this one. He says, in rereading my post, I realized that this is screwed up. Yes, when you hit the remote control again, unlock, the door makes a sound. However, I now realize this isn't relocking, it's just making that unlocking sound again, I think. At the time, second incident, I recall that when I tried to get into my car after turning off the other person's alarm, I found that my door was locked. Duh, I had just unlocked it. I then assumed that I had relocked my car door, even though I had presumably used unlock to turn off the alarm, as that was what the button is used that I had used resulted in the alarm turning on. Damn. If and when this happens again, so far, three times in about as many months, I'll have to study the phenomenon more closely.
That whole problem can be avoided by buying cars that are 10 years old and don't have any power locks or alarms.
Actually, they don't even have to be 10 years old. Mine's 2 years old.
Ah.
It's got power locks, but it doesn't have any remote control.
Ah, you're wise, my friend. You just have to get the cheap cars.
This is just another classic example of low-tech being the better answer.
Yeah.
It really is.
Simple things cannot break down.
They can, but it's a hell of a lot more difficult.
Like air-cooled motorcycle cooling systems.
My door ajar lights on, and my doors aren't ajar.
I know. Eh.
No, they're doors, aren't they?
If any callers would like to call in and complain about that joke.
I'd like to schedule time for a rebuttal.
Mo, go ahead now.
Go for it.
I forgot what I was going to say.
Again?
All right. It happens quite often.
Yeah, I've been noticing that, actually.
You're quite astute in noticing that.
Anyway, we're just about out of time here. So I think without any further ado, we're going to call it a wrap. You've been listening to Little Brother, episode 15, for August 3rd, 2001, and I am cutting these guys off. You're listening to Little Brother, episode 15, for August 3rd, 2001. All right, I'll put you guys back on. Hang on. There you go.
You can't just control one microphone at a time.
No censorship,
please.
Actually, I could do. I could just fade him down a little bit. That. Okay. Anyway. All right. I won't censor you, but please knock it off.
Okay.
Okay.
I'm just having my fun.
I know. Let's see. If you want to send your opinions and views to me, please feel free to critter@verizoneatspoop.com. Website where you can download this program if you feel so inclined is www.tricityads.com. Thanks to Phil for lending me that domain name. And contrary to the name, there are no ads on tricityads.com.
It's just easy to remember.
Yeah, it is. It really is. And if you would rather have the long one, it's www.critternet.mine.nu. And that's going to be a wrap. This is WRPI, Troy.